This podcast is brought to you by Marriage Equality Campaign Wellington and PrideNZ.com.
This session is really a summary session, a report back from each of the streams. So we've got a report back from Ian from Queer Avengers and also from William, who will do the Legalised Love stream. We'll have a look at the action points and also the whiteboard, the different tasks that some of the major tasks that some of the different groups are going to be doing over the next 3 to 6 months. And then we'll say a few thank yous and farewell until next time. So I'll start off and hand over to Ian, who's going to quickly talk about the Queer Avengers stream and give us a detailed report, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I'll report on the first half, and could you, you wrote some notes on the second half. Do you want to report back on that?
Yeah.
Cool. So, the first two sessions were a trans forum and a Tangata Pacifica forum. The trans forum it started with Sally presenting on particularly on the suicidality in that suicidality among marginalised groups in general, and then sort of moving into good ways to address that. So, for example, surgery has been made much more freely available, it's had a huge impact on suicidality. So discussing some of the basic things where if the concerns are addressed, again, as Joseph mentioned, if surgery isn't seen as just an elective thing for a very small group who have the money, that actually has a huge impact on that. So, and then Chase talked about experiences in high school and having relatively okay experiences, but especially compared to other people who've been kicked out of home and all this, but still having issues with a lack of education and constantly being faced with questions kind of thing. So we also talked about the need for education. So I think those are both big things to return to. Expansion of consistent across the board healthcare for trans people and also education on gender and sexuality. So we ran through some of the Crow School's demands along those lines. And other people can possibly comment on that. I might not have summarised it perfectly. And then we did the Tangata Pacifica Forum, which was Fetu from, she's from Box Events, which is a sort of queer woman of colour group, except she was there pretty much as an individual, just speaking on some of the problems of the phrase was beyond queer liberation, and so sort of that a lot of articulations of queerness are in a sort of in a colonised space, and at the same time colonisation is what's eroded previous forms such as whawhawhine, and so the thing of articulating something that deals with those sorts of different strands and takes up both spaces, similar to how Takatāpui is an integration of those things. Fetu could speak to that better, but she's not here. That's something we're going to revisit and keep having dialogue on. So that was the first half.
Okay. So the first afternoon one was a talk about the gay liberation movement that was done by Ian, which started talking about the Stonewall riots in the US, and that was when a group of gay, the police raided this bar where gay men and trans people hung out, I think mostly gay men and transsexual women, and one time they decided to fight back. And these were actually people who had been active in other new left movements, and sort of like against racial segregation and against the war in Vietnam and fighting for women's rights and so on. And they thought, well, hey, let's stick up for ourselves as well. So they started fighting back. And apparently the most dispossessed gay and trans people were really big, and they were the ones who were most passionate about fighting back. Yes, strangely enough, it was maybe the ones who were least dispossessed who actually got the most boost in their rights from it. And, they formed this group called the Gay Liberation Front, which then split into a gay activist alliance and a street trans action revolutionary group. And because they sort of, it's like they had different ideas of what to focus on. And the gay group was successful in getting it so that it was no longer considered a mental illness to be gay. And so, it was interesting that you got that sort of split. And then, the gay group, which was perhaps the more mainstream one, they got what they wanted. The trans group kind of didn't really. And so this kind of posed the question of how do we be together in a unitary that is emancipatory rather than sort of oppressive by sort of saying you conform to this so that we can be together. And we learnt about how the gay rights activists had alliances with various people, including the Labour Truck Drivers Union in San Francisco, which I found surprising. I mean, stereotypically, this was a gay man being allied with the truck drivers. I would have thought, maybe some of the female truck drivers might have been in favour of gay rights, but you don't stereotypically think of the male truck drivers as feeling that way.
It's my contact list on Facebook.
Well, that was mediated by Harvey Milk doing sort of the community work with both groups.
Yes. And so we started discussing, we talked a bit about New Zealand also, but then we started discussing what does this tell us about our campaigns now? And one point that Bill made was that there was this clear division between the more mainstream and the more sort of off to the side thing was actually matched by the architectural context of this conference, with maybe the more mainstream group meeting in this room and the more off to the side group in that room. And but we worked out that actually it had been needing both in a way had been important to moving forward. And another thing we learned was that a lot of these groups that popped up in the 60s and 70s and so on, they were sort of, it was sort of like a new way for people standing up and saying these things publicly and getting in the public eye. But they weren't the first movement saying these things. That you can actually look back decades and find academics writing these things and people having these discussions. And so what changed was the sort of public, the making it public side. And somebody commented that actually gay people who want to get married are maybe not the most oppressed people in the queer community, and that there's a concern that maybe shifting same-sex marriage, that maybe the same-sex marriage campaign might be shifting marriage from the same-sex marriage from being in the category of abnormal stuff to being in the category of normal stuff, while not actually changing anything about the fact of there being these two categories. And so there was sort of this tension, I think, also between, sometimes you can drop the more controversial stuff and get the less controversial stuff through, and you might think, oh, well, that's a good deal, because at least we've got something through, otherwise we weren't going to get anything. But on the other hand, there was, well, then once you got the more popular bit through, maybe you lose the impetus to campaign, so that actually stops the other bit getting through. So not sure where that leads to as to how you should work. Then we had the Beyond Marriage Forum, where this was basically talking about this concept, Bill suggested, what if we abolished marriage as an institution and, people could just do what they want but not be, they could live like they're married if they want to, but not be influenced by this being sort of an institution that has certain advantages and so on. And Anne talked about free love, which didn't necessarily mean a sort of hippie style having like lots of sex or free of emotional connection or anything, but what it meant was love that is free from, I guess, free from expectations as to what is the right sort of love or the right sort of sex life, so that you're free to find what is the best sort for you. And she said that we live in a sex-negative culture, which she then clarified was a sex-negative culture that's disguised as a sex-positive culture, by which meant that we have this sort of media and advertising in our culture sort of promoting sex as a good thing, but then promoting it along with youth and conventional ideas of beauty and physical perfection, as if to maybe sort of imply that that without that it's not a good thing. And that sends, you know, messages that people's own love life or sex life maybe isn't good enough. And so her idea of free love would include being free from that. And she talked about, so she wasn't, I mean, she was into the idea of, you know, polygamy and
polyamory
and sharing sexual and emotional partners if that's what you want. I mean, it wasn't about necessarily doing that, but it definitely included the freedom for people to choose that if that's what seemed to suit them. And what's your name?
Shelley
mentioned that in the BDSM community they have this sort of negotiation system for how where people negotiate what they can get from one relationship and sort of say, oh, and if you need more from a relationship than this, I recognise that you might get that other thing from another relationship. So that might be part of it. And Bill then sort of ended this by saying, well, and this wasn't really a disagreement, but just an extension and tying back to what he said at the beginning, you can't argue for free love. Instead, you have to argue against various things that are barriers to freedom and love. And got a list of books for further reading that you can get from me if you're interested in this. There's some about sort of political stuff about free love, some about sort of interpersonal relationship issues in free love. Then the third one was the diversity forum. So we first talked about queer relationships and disability, and mentioned, you know, things about how disabled people, whether they're straight or queer, might find it harder to leave a relationship. But disabled people, specifically disabled queer people, might be affected also by homophobia by their carers or family who are caring for them. That under immigration law, because there is discrimination, well, New Zealand immigration law that isn't really about, you know, same-sex versus opposite-sex relationships, but there is on the grounds of disability. So you might find that, if you're in love with somebody from a different country who's of the same sex as you and they have a disability, then maybe they can't come here. So you have to go there, to their country, where maybe you can't actually get in on the, where maybe your relationship isn't recognised as it would be in New Zealand. And yeah, there was also this idea that that there might be more pressure to sort of prove your normality in terms of sexuality if you've got a disability and are therefore perceived as abnormal in that respect, that it's maybe easier to sort of be different, be openly abnormal in a way. In one respect, if you're clearly normal in another. And then we got on to trans issues as the middle of the second of the three parts of this diversity thing. So we discussed, is marriage equality an issue for trans people? So Brooklyn, who was presenting, said that it is partly, well, can be, because you can be trans and homosexual as well, but it can also be, it's also because the legal definition of what sex somebody is can be a bit messed up for transsexual people and can change over time. And so, like, in New Zealand at the moment, if you have particular irreversible transsexual surgery or medical treatment, you go from being the opposite sex of your legal partner to being the same sex of your legal partner, then your marriage is annulled. Because I'm not sure whether it's annulled or if it's equal, but anyway, it's whatever it is, it ceases to be legally valid. So, it's because of the sort of confusion around legal definition of sex and change in legal definition of sex makes a special transsexual angle on removing gender from removing the rule that you have to be a man and a woman to be married. And Brooklyn also talked about this idea of trans women being hypersexualised in some people's imaginations, which apparently means that make marriage difficult because it leads to the sort of idea that you're not going to be wanted, that nobody would want to marry you. And so this means that, there are some cases of trans women being married to regular cissexual men. There are also just as many trans women being married to trans men or being in lesbian type relationships. And that means, suggests actually, considering there are way more cis men than trans men, that actually that there is, that those relationships with cis men are difficult to form. And then there's discrimination against trans men being sometimes physically beaten up by lesbians who saw them as traitors to the, I don't know, radical lesbian separatist cause or something. I wouldn't know, I'm not involved in the radical lesbian separatist cause, I don't think they'd let me in. There's discrimination against trans people, which is not explicitly prohibited. It's kind of a weird one, because there's a legal opinion that it is implied under sexual discrimination in the Human Rights Act. Now, but the fact that it's not actually explicitly stated means it's kind of, it's hard to know really whether you would actually get protection. And also mentioned that trans women have a high rate of mental and neurological disability, which I'm sure has negative effects. It's also had positive effects in terms of developing relationships between the trans community and the community of other people with those conditions, which has meant that at least those two communities accept each other. Then thirdly, we talked about the tapu'i, or basically Maori queer identity, where Gareth said that basically the written Maori history is heterosexual Maori men's history, and that this has meant that there's like 300-year-old stories of tapu'i, which have only been written down in the last 20 years or so, and a lot of members of the Maori establishment sort of frown on these stories and kind of don't really accept them as part of their inheritance, but they are stories that have always been passed down through Maori people. And part of this was due to also missionaries who came along and burnt all these carvings, which suggested same-sex relationships. And there was a point that Takatakawe have actually been big in the campaign for reviving the Maori language. So that's quite a good sort of, I guess, alliance there between the campaign for Maori language and the Takatakawe. And some of this whole thing of the missionaries destroying the evidence of the Takatakawe relationships has led to some people like John Tamahiri and Brian Haneke, who I've mentioned, as Maori people who thought that those traditions didn't exist because they hadn't been passed down to them. And finally, I got this interesting comment from Brooklyn, who said that she thought that we should see all forms of oppression as basically this one sort of oppression thing that's divided into these different forms. And that, therefore, if you get somebody who's part of one group where they're the oppressed and another group where they're sort of the oppressor, that's actually a sort of divide and rule thing, pitting them against each other, which is also sort of part of what she sees as this whole big complex of oppression. Thank you.
So I'm going to keep this quicker because I'm aware of the time. So to start off the Legalised Love stream yesterday, we had Conrad Rayners, who's leading a lot of the media work around the campaign and a lot of the lobbying, talk to us. So we started with a quick overview of the process that's happened so far and what we've still got to go as far as second and third reading and when our lobbying is going to be most effective. The people we were encouraged to target are the 80 voting in favour at the moment and keeping those people yeses. And that is going to be the most effective strategy for us. We talked about how we need to tailor our messages to those people so that the right people are lobbying different MPs and lobbying them in the right way, depending on their party affiliations and how liberal they are. We talked about speaking to the heart as being more effective than speaking to the head. So as many logical reasons we have for marriage equality to be passed, they should probably be secondary to the emotional stories. And we talked about some of the risks, which you can read about in the notes. After that, we had Dr. Elspeth Tilley from Massey University, who gave a really good, some really good advice around media. It's basically, the way she put it is that the people we want to reach are not the media themselves, but the end audiences of those publications, and we need to think about those audiences. But obviously the media is the intermediary with that, so we need to understand, you know, who journalists are, and she talked about how they are predominantly young white women with a tertiary qualification and relatively little experience, and how we need to bring them up to speed on some of the issues so that they can provide effective coverage. We also got into some specifics about some media angles we might take over the campaign. So one advice was to create competition. And so we looked at, you know, New Zealand becoming one of the first countries in the world. We sort of have an expectation upon us that we will legalise marriage equality after we were first to give women the vote. And we looked at a lot of other angles too that we might push in the media sphere. And more practically, we looked at how we might write a media release and handle issues with the media. Then we heard from Tabby, Tom, and someone else whose name I can't remember.
Griffin
on queer straight alliances. And they gave a good overview of what they're doing in schools and the national network they're creating. And hopefully we can grab their slides and they'll be available for those who weren't in that session. We also looked at some questions that came from that. How can we make these groups a true alliance between queer people and straight people? How we resource those people, but also resource teachers, who are the other big players in schools. How we handle cultural issues. And we looked at a couple of examples of people doing it right, like Wellington High School. And another nice point that was mentioned was, you know, the QSA is coming from the bottom up, creating these groups, but what can we do at the policy level to filter down and make Queer Australia Alliances and queer issues a priority in our education sector. After that, we had a very informative but also thought-provoking session from Mary about faith. Margaret, yeah. So I thought that name was wrong, and I've written it down like that. She started off with, I guess, an analysis of, like, the key arguments we hear from religious factions and sort of broke some of those down for us. But we went further to sort of look at some of the other sort of sideline issues within the whole faith domain. For example, the missing voice of people who are against gay marriage in a religious sense but believe that there should be a civil right to marriage because of their general belief in equality. That's the point I'll try and articulate better in the notes. And also the fact that some churches do support marriage equality, and the current law is currently preventing them from exercising their religious freedom. That's a point Kay's brought up a few times, and I really like that. We looked at some of the reasons that we have objection and where that comes from, and some strategies to deal with perhaps ignorant people that we come across. Then Kevin Haig talked to us about marriage, adoption and human rights, and that was a really interesting discussion. We started looking at the international human rights instruments, like the UN Declaration and its sort of sister instruments, and how those filtered down into our domestic legislation and the effect that those have had. One of the really interesting things from Kevin's session was sort of the peculiar but compelling argument about the effect that so good social policy has on public health. And we looked at the example of HIV/AIDS, and it was found that the people, during the epidemic of the 80s, the people who were being infected were typically people with low self-esteem, alcohol and drug problems, poor communication skills, and in denial about their sexuality, and how solving those problems would have the positive effect on health, obviously, in that case, HIV infection rates. So we looked at something called the Ottawa Charter and some principles around developing good human rights policy. And we also looked at the issue of adoption, the Care of Children Act and the Adoption Act, and where we need to go with that, and some sort of issues for beyond the marriage equality campaign. But certainly the issues with that go far beyond adoption equality and go into some sort of interesting concepts that, like whānau adoption and giving legal effect to open adoption, which at the moment is sort of done off the books. And yeah, that's where they concluded.
Cool, thank you, William.